Well, it's been many weeks, maybe even a month. Is that right, since we recorded?
It feels like forever. I've missed the podcast. I haven't missed you. Oh. I just missed the concept of you.
You're so sweet. You're a nice person.
Just read it off the card.
That's right. Well, I miss you too. You know, there's a lot going on here at the Cote house, but I thought we need to record an episode before we forget that it happens.
Yes. So you've never been to London City Airport.
No. I was as a point of reference, I'm going on a little European tour the last week of June. I think I'm going to fly to Amsterdam, then I'm going to go to Cologne, if that's a real place. Then I'm going to go to Munich. And then back to Amsterdam, and there's a great flight. I might be in Houston that weekend where I'm flying out, and there's a great flight from Houston that goes to directly to Heathrow, which I think that's a great airport. People hate all airports. I don't know what their problem is. I could tell you about the Singapore airport in a while. That's a good airport. So you go into Heathrow, and then there's like a 3.5 hour layover, and if you're not careful, you won't notice that the airport code changes and you got to go to the Lucy, the London City Airport. So,
London City Airport, yeah.
So what's up with the London City Airport?
So many, many years ago, I took my first flight. This is a very long time ago. And for some reason, I had no idea why I was doing this. But I don't know, decided to fly from London to Dublin in the Republic of Ireland. Mm. And the flight was from London City Airport to Dublin. And this is the first airport I'd ever really been to. I was quite a young person. And London City Airport is basically a kind of wasteland in between two docks, or next to one large dock in the old Docklands in London, East London. Mm. And which means that it's quite a scary approach. I mean, you're coming down in between water and the Thames and all these kind of like high-rise buildings and, you know, Canary Wharf, all those blocks there. And the plane I got into was a bit like like an estate car with wings. And they took all the luggage off me, which is just like one bag, and chucked it in the back and sort of slammed the boot, as we would say. And the whole plane shook. And then you get in there. Oh, it was terrifying. It was absolutely terrifying.
Did they have someone out front who pulled on their propeller to get it started?
I can't remember whether it even had a propeller. Yes, it probably did have. I think it was a twin propeller plane. Mm. But this was so long ago. It was before all the, you know, take your belt off, take your shoes off stuff. So, yeah, it was a pretty hair-raising experience. But I did a lot of much longer flights after that. But I have never been. I went again in a really tiny plane, but yeah, that I'm not a good plane traveler, really.
Mm, yeah, yeah. They call those puddle jumpers over here.
Yes, yeah, really tiny, really tiny. It's a nice place, and I expect you can get from London City to Amsterdam and back, or wherever in that part of Europe, really quickly. But yeah, pretty small.
Yeah, I think, you know, I'm assuming I would have to take like a car or something. I don't know. Maybe you would know the bus lines to take, but probably best to take a car.
Yeah, from Heathrow to London City. Yeah, definitely. Or the tube, as we call it, metro.
Could oh, the tube. Here's the other reason. So you know if you're in the Slack channel, not you, because I know you are, but listeners, I'm moving to Amsterdam, me and the family. I was telling someone this earlier today, and they asked if the kids and my wife were coming. I was like, I didn't know that was optional.
What do you mean by moving? You say you didn't say, I don't know.
Yeah, no. I haven't asked them. I was going to ask them the day of the flight.
I hadn't thought of that.
That's right. But in order to contain... That's right. They are. And the dog. Not the lizard. Oh. We're gonna dump the lizard, and
I totally forgot about the dog.
Mm-hmm, got a dog. We'll see how that works out. Hopefully, this won't limit our housing options.
Has the dog been in a plane before?
No.
No. Oh, wow.
See if she survives. This is gonna be. This is, you know, as as with all pets, I said, dogs are great. I'm a dad. I recommend we don't get a dog. And several years later, we have a dog. Dog is adorable. I like the dog. She's nice. But, you know, just one more thing to worry about. Yeah. I don't know
you
what
had
it
dogs
is about.
For some time,
definitely. Yeah. There was a space where I didn't have dogs. I had two Great Pyrenees, which are great dogs.
I remember.
And to answer the questions, yes, they are hot. And yep, they're the ones walking me. Who, you know, those are the two questions you would always get. Oh, the one that I actually like was like, you bet they eat a lot.
Yeah,
exactly. You know, I often think, and I'll go back to maybe I won't, but the car thing is like, I think maybe if I slowed down and I thought about what people were saying to me instead of like intuitively answering, life would be better and more entertaining. Because, you know, I find that when I'm in conversation with most people, my goal is just to like get away. And so I'm trying to like, I'm just like saying
no,
anything. That's right. I'm trying to say anything to like agree with them and wrap it up and like move, right? And get out of there. So consequently, right now, this isn't the case when I'm like hanging out with someone, you know, on my own volition usually. Yeah. But you know, like for example, you're walking the two Great Pyrenees in the park, and someone's like, "Oh, I bet they eat a lot," and you're just like, "Huh? Yeah." And then you keep walking, right?
Yeah.
But I feel like if I would slow down and listen and think, they would, you know, you'd be walking to Great Pyrenees in the park here in August, 100 degrees maybe, and and maybe someone would say, "Oh, I bet they get hot." And I, if I was slow, I could say something like, "Not hotter than me," or you know, or as you quipped, right? Like, you know, those sure, I bet they eat a lot. How do you think they got so big? I don't know, but instead I'm just the guy who's like, gotta keep walking. I don't know what's up with that. So the reason I needed to take a car and let me close it out is to contain costs. We're not going to spend $90,000 to like transatlantic ship things. And instead we're going to get $10,000 to go to IKEA and just buy some shit when we move there.
Oh, cool.
But this does mean we need to like, you know, we're not just going to go to like HEMA or H&M and buy a full wardrobe. So we're trying to maximize the suitcases that we're taking over in the meantime. So I've purchased a storage locker in Amsterdam. You probably know what this means. It's a meter by a meter and 3 meters high. That seems really high. I guess so you can put 3 golf bags perfectly stacked on each other in it. I don't know.
Or two young children standing on one of the shoulders in a very big kind of like raincoat.
That's right. The one on top has achieved great things, but on the shoulders of midgets. Anyways, so on this trip, because I'm going to Amsterdam, I would be taking two luggage. And that's why I would need to take a car because I don't want to go in the tube with two giant pieces of luggage plus a carry-on and a backpack.
No. That's madness.
I'll just get on the tube and be like, golly, I'm just in from Texas. This sure is amazing. Is there some sort of elevator around here? Where's your bathroom? Because I got to go before I pee my pants.
Yeah, that'll go down a storm.
I went to floor one, and it seems to be floor two. What's going on over here?
You really are tired, aren't you?
Sorry,
so anyway,
I keep interrupting you.
It's the lag. It's lag. It's nowhere near as bad as Skype. Thank God, Skype for business. So that those guides they have for like if you're moving to another city or something like that. So if you're moving to Amsterdam or something. I always think they should have in those guides the things that are easy to get in that place and the things that are hard to get. So when you're talking about all the stuff you need to take there, I can imagine thinking, wow, shoes are really cheap in Amsterdam, or shoes are really expensive in Amsterdam, but you don't know until you just kind of think, well, I wonder how much shoes are here. And then you go into a shoe shop and you think, oh my God, this is insane.
That is a one. I'm going to write that down in my OmniFocus. So when Kim and I are over there,
yeah,
let's price a basket of goods.
That's going to make no sense in about 10 minutes.
What's cheap there? No. I'm going to write in a note.
Oh,
like
right.
Shoes, clothes. I mean, I don't know what else you would want to look at. I mean, those are the only things we can really bring. Cosmetics.
Yeah.
You know, I'm guessing based on the fact that duty-free stores are such a big deal in European airports, stuff is, I don't know, isn't that like 15-20%?
Yes, it is. Yeah. It's 20%.
I guess though, I'll speak for myself. I don't want to reveal anything about my wife, but you know, I don't buy cologne or cigarettes. Buy liquor. So,
yep.
You know, I don't know if the duty-free matters. That's a good idea though. How much are shoes? Because Jesus Christ, when you got a 4-year-old and a 6-year-old, they wear shoes for like 5 hours.
That is exactly what I was thinking. That really is they go through Crocs like maniacs, just burn through them.
So we might just need to bring a suitcase full of Skechers and just
and sell them at a massive markup. Yeah.
Ooh, I like the way you think. How can I make more money out of this trip?
By exploiting my children.
It'll be some Dickinsonian thing. I'll have Cormac, I should really know off the top of my head how old he is. I'll have him go out on the street corner and open up a suitcase full of American shoes.
American shoes.
That's right. And just be like, blimey, these are 30 pounds a shoe, 60 pounds for two, for a pair.
So have you drunk anything in Amsterdam? Because all I can remember is they have. Your Dutch is better than mine. Geneva, that old Geneva and young Geneva, which I think is a form of gin.
Right.
I don't believe we have any Dutch listeners shouting at us right now. Then they have those ales, don't they? Like the Trappist monk stuff.
Oh yeah, that's Belgian though.
Okay. Ooh.
Here's the cuisine advice. I'm going to be updating this, but I've asked. As you can imagine, every time I go somewhere, I ask people, and I have to be. I guess if you don't speak English natively, let alone American, like this doesn't make sense. So I have to qualify. But I'm basically like, what's the deal with food around here? Like I said that in a negative tone. And I'm like, hey, what's the deal with food around here? And, you know, people are a little confused, but I just mean, what's the deal?
Yeah.
And so when I've asked that of Dutch people and Belgian people, the Dutch people say the following. They're like, don't eat Dutch food and drink Belgian beer.
Okay.
And then the Belgians are like, we have good beer. And so the people up there in the lowlands, so to speak, they don't think too highly of their food. Now, however, let me add some amendments here. If that's some quotas. People have told me that in the Netherlands, you want to eat the Indonesian food, and that's really good food.
Oh, yeah.
I think it's analogous to the Indian food in the UK.
Yeah.
So I'm going to look forward to that.
In Rotterdam, there was food from Suriname, so the Indonesian food, but also the kind of local food. Okay, it's a bit kind of Euro food, but it was great. I really liked it. But then my tastes are very, very Puritan.
So what was the food? Give me some character of it.
Well, characterless. That's how I like my food. Bland.
You know, it's funny you should say that now that I'm going on this big mega trip. You know, I'm not going to be able to fly on my beloved American very much when I'm in Europe, which is sadly probably kept me up a total of 3 extra hours over the past week, just trying to go to sleep. And I'm just running the traps through my head of how to sort that out. First of all, when I was booking on Lufthansa or like KLM or something today, and there was a drop down for meal selection, and one of them was apparently the Robert Brooks special. It said, you know, you've got vegetarian, like, you know, halal, vegetarian, Indian, blah, blah, blah. There's a big selection, but one of them was bland.
Bland. Just put it out there.
I'll have to take a screenshot of that, but... No, seriously, it was like bland. there's some like classically trained French chef in the airline meal system, you know, like graduated in the bottom 10% of his class, and he's like he or she is like, oh, is Italian. They need bland. And he's just, that was my French accent. And it's just driving them crazy that they have to have bland. So the reason I stay up at night to catharsize some more is, after this, I'm going on a trip to Amsterdam to look around for neighborhoods. And when I get back from this trip, I will have achieved executive platinum, which is more or less the highest tier on American. Some might think of it as a tier, right. T-E-A-R, because you travel so much. But it's really because I've gone to Asia like twice on business class, which gives you a multiplier, but whatever. And what that means is you get like all the privileges. You get like, you know, 200 times the miles, and you can pick any seat, and you usually get upgraded on domestic flights, and you can go to like the fanciest lounges when you're traveling international. So it's just, nice. You know, it's what you shoot for when you travel a lot. So there's two other layers of consternation, or the two layers of consternation. Yeah. Oh yeah. So first of all is when I'm in Europe. Yes. So now there was a bit of competition of me moving to London or Amsterdam, right? Now, I don't know if you're familiar with this, but you could reverse engineer it from the name. London is the headquarters and hub of British Air, which is a valued One World Airline Alliance partner that American is in. So things would have been fine, right? Fly on BA everywhere. But if the listener remembers, I'm not moving to London. I'm moving to Amsterdam. Now, what do they have One World in Amsterdam? Well, there's like two flights on BA to London every day. And there's something that goes to like Amman on Air Jordan, which that's a little bit of a connection to make to go to like Munich. So you don't have that. And maybe Iberia might, I don't know if they even fly to Madrid, but basically then you got Royal Dutch Airlines, KLM. They're based there. They fly anywhere you want direct, basically. So now KLM is a member of SkyTeam. Is Cote involved with SkyTeam in any way? Not at all. I'm a nobody to SkyTeam. So.
You're just a schmuck on the street.
Yeah. So there you go. So now the third piece of consternation. So the summary is I'm just going to have to build up my status on KLM, which whatever. Plus, as I'm sure you know, when you're, would you say intra-Europe on the continent, it's just like you can fly anywhere for like $100, but you can't really pick your airline. And it's always like an hour somewhere. Yeah. So it's different than the US. Like in the US, especially for living in Austin, like it's always going to take you like 5 to 6 hours kind of at best to get anywhere. Because in Austin, you got to fly to Dallas. And then for people who aren't familiar with the US is fucking huge. So anywhere you want to go takes. That's right. I don't know. But then the only other annoying thing is like the last time I earned executive platinum is when I stopped working at Red Monk and went to go work at Bell, where I didn't travel at all. So both times, as you say, it'll be dashed from my hands.
So wait a minute.
That's a pattern.
Do you lose the status?
Yes. It only lasts for a year.
I didn't know. I thought it was like you were getting a medal.
No, they do send you a little card. They're like, thanks. If you need a referral to a divorce lawyer, we can provide it for you.
That's nice. really nice. Now,
the way it works, like, just because I'm sure you're fascinated and I like talking about it, is The year is 2018. So you lose your status, whatever status you had on February 1st, right? And you have to fly the miles, however many you have to fly, 100,000 miles to be America, to be executive platinum. And once you fly that in the year, you become executive platinum, right? And then you get that the next calendar year. So I will become executive platinum at the, you know, June 20th or some shit, right?
Right.
So I will be executive platinum for the rest of the year and then all of 2019. You see how that works out?
Yeah.
Now, my understanding, I've spent a lot of time researching how Flying Blue, which is the KLM and Air France, which turns out are owned by the same people. That's their program. Now, the way their program works, slightly different, is the first time you fly in a 12-month period, you start gaining, I shit you not, XP. Like, they have some Dungeons and Dragons person there. You get experience points. So you get XP, and then the clock starts ticking, and you have 12 months to qualify for a status. And then the weird thing is, once you get one level of status, which for them the lowest level of status is silver, then it starts the clock over again to get to the next level of status. It's very confusing. I don't know. These are the things I worry about.
The thing that concerns me is that you seem so put out by the idea of flying like a normal person. Flying like a normal person now sounds like the worst thing in the world. It's like you get cattle prodded onto this.
Yeah. Well, I'm close, Robert. I need a few more sessions. But last night when I was trying to go to sleep, there's various reasons why I was up till 2 a.m. But when I was trying to go to sleep, what I settled on was like, it'll be okay, right? Like, let's remember the Tom Petty / Buddhist approach to life. Like, most things I worry about will never happen anyway, right? Mm-hmm. It'll be okay. And then also the scheme will be, I will just fly on Oneworld as much as possible. And then as makes sense, I'll fly in KLM and other stuff. Because that's just, you can't really, if you're flying around Europe, you can't really get status on an airline. Yeah. That doesn't really work. And then sure enough, today I was booking some trips and I'll be flying on a Oneworld carrier, KLM and Lufthansa, which are three separate alliances, right? So you just like whatever. But what you get in return, and I think hopefully this is part of your point, is a flight from Cologne to Munich is an hour, right?
Yeah.
And then a flight from Munich to Amsterdam is an hour.
Yeah.
So like, I'll spend less time flying around, which is probably fine.
Yeah.
But it is, you know, and I don't know if you've heard this episode, but there was a Roderick on the episode where he was complaining about how Delta had screwed him out of airline status. And yeah. I was like, oh brother, you don't know the half of it.
That's me. Join the queue.
Yeah. And it is like, I get it. You know, people complain about airlines and rightly so, but it's like, man, this is like joining the army. There's like a system. This is just like, you gotta figure it out. There's no mercy. That's the way it happens. You know.
So occasionally I do toy with the idea of going into Europe on the train.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's the thing you can do. And mm-hmm. the difference between what is called second class and what's called first class is often not that much money. So in the UK, so if I want to go from, say, London to Brighton, the first class ticket can often be a lot more money than second class, like a huge amount more money. But going on Eurostar or Thales or one of the other kind of intercity things in Europe, it's usually like 20 or 30 euros more. It's hardly anything.
Yeah.
And I look at that and think, wow, what's first class like in these things? And first class on the trains, some of them are really good, like really, really good. I mean, really nice. I mean, I went in a couple of trains in the Netherlands and in France recently where I thought, wow, I'd love to go in this carriage. It looks fantastic. And then I realized that was just second class. It was amazing. Yeah. It was brilliant. I thought, wow, I'm going to say this is brilliant. Love it.
Yeah.
I'm definitely going to, next time I go on a longer trip, I'm going to seriously consider upgrading.
And yeah, you know, like 3 years ago, I took the Eurostar from London to Brussels, and we went like at least business class.
Yeah.
And yeah, it was nice to give you a meal. You got all your stuff, but yeah. And I noticed that I'm going to take a train from Amsterdam to Cologne, which is like 2.5 hours or something absurdly short. And and the difference is, like you say, is like 20 or 30 euros. It's crazy.
And there's, again, I'm sure I've spoken about it before, but my God, those trains go fast. 300 kilometers an hour. I mean, that is, it's just a blur. It's fantastic. Love it.
So what's the, I mean, I realize you're up there in jolly old England, so there's a bit of a filter on the following, right? But what's like the European stance on like paying in your taxes for trains? And let me make a qualifying statement after this. I feel like in the US, as evidenced by what we do, we are not willing to pay for good trains. Like, I don't think that as a populace here in the US, we're like stupid about it. You know what I mean? Like, we sort of know we could pay a lot of money and have really good trains. Like, I think there's enough people who have that figured out. No one's like, I don't know, trains suck, right? Like people know that trains are good.
Your American accent is really unconvincing.
That's good, dude. Like when I'm talking normally or when I make something up?
Yeah.
That's good. I'm often told that people are confused when I tell them I'm from Texas, and they're like, but you don't have an accent. And I'm like, yeah, but you sure are an asshole. See, that's something I would think of if I slowed down. And I would have a lot less friends if I slowed down and thought, I think. But so it seems like, what's the European deal with paying for trains?
I don't wish to voice an opinion that could be considered political.
I mean, you don't speak for all of Europe?
Or indeed anything at all, yes. there has been our rail system in the UK was basically privatized, I don't know how long ago, 20 years ago or 30 years ago, something like that. And we have the benefits and the disbenefits of a privatized system. So a lot of it is basically just in time and, you know, loads of leasing companies and that sort of stuff. And people, companies getting the franchise for a few years and then, you know, getting bailed out and that sort of stuff. So it's pretty mad. But the trains, it's really difficult because traveling across Europe by train is great, but it's also money. And whenever there is a new train system going in, so in the UK there's been High Speed 1 and there's a new system called High Speed 2 coming, and it's taken so long and it's costing so much money that you almost have to convince yourself that it's going to be okay. Mm. And it's all going to be worth the effort in the end. And we've got this other system called Crossrail going sort of in a huge tunnel under London. And it'll all work out, but the amount of money and the amount of time it takes is just, you know, you're not going to see a return on this for a long, long time.
Anything
to improve the trains in the UK. The trains in the UK are could do with a lot of improvement, particularly if you compare it to most of the European system. But it's no Amtrak.
Now, do you think maybe, at least in the UK too, but do you think maybe it also has to do with size? Like, it's a small enough geography that it's not insanely expensive? Like, you know, a train between Austin and San Francisco, I don't even know how many miles that would be. It's a long way. So that's a lot of, but it's frustrating because we do have track everywhere. I don't know. It's weird.
That is kind of strange. And it is, and there are parts of, say, Portugal or Spain where there are tracks, but they're just not used for passenger trains. And the idea of getting a passenger train to that place seems absurd. And people get coaches. I mean, you know, it's like, why don't you use the train? Presumably it just doesn't make enough money.
Yeah. You can't just hop onto a boxcar. No. Sing a song and eat some chili?
No.
It's too bad.
No. What are you going to miss?
Oh, about the U.S.?
Particularly about where you're moving from.
I've been compiling a mental list. I'll exegesize. Or no, just that's the wrong word. Well, one, it's been my observation that because as you probably remember, I enjoy touring the grocery stores of the world. That's mm-hmm. perhaps one of my favorite activities to do. you know, it doesn't take long. You can get a sense of what's going on, get something to eat. It's fun. But I've noticed that when it comes to Mexican food, as the world would say, never mind Tex-Mex food, all they really sell is Old El Paso, which
yes.
I don't know what brand that would be. I don't know what, just yeah, I think I could summarize it by, I don't know, but I don't know what brand, I don't know what brand would be equivalent like in your neck of the woods if you saw it abroad, but I would never buy Old El Paso. Like, I don't think I have ever bought any Old El Paso because, like, just no.
Okay. Right. Okay. I understand. Now, okay, my point of view here is there's good news and there's not good news. The not good news is I think the likelihood of anyone, including you, finding good Mexican or Tex-Mex food in, I don't know, Amsterdam is low. Mm-hmm. I think you're correct in imagining this. And you may at some stage have to walk past the yellow wall of shame that is Old El Paso.
I love that you know that shelf area so well.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, oh, yeah. Yeah. Old El Paso.
The warning signs. Nature's warning sign. Old El Paso. Uh-huh. But the thing is, the good news, I think, is your point about touring grocery stores is one of the things I remember about Rotterdam. The grocery stores are really interesting. I mean, I think your point is well made that you can go there and you can get a feel of the place. You really can. And there was quite a range, even in Rotterdam, which is obviously smaller than Amsterdam. I could go into lots of different grocery places and, you know, just like moon around like I do. It was fantastic. You're going to love it.
Yeah, it is fun. And you got all the European cheeses and the wines. Oh, so nice.
Yeah.
And I'll be missing some, you know, Mexican food. Now, I haven't tested this out. My theory is that maybe some of these things I can find a substitute for at Whole Foods. I'll see. There's some Whole Foods around. I don't know if they have any in Amsterdam.
Yeah.
But I found the one in London there in Piccadilly to be, that seemed good.
Adequate.
And there probably are some, you know, international stores. We'll see what they carry. But the problem is like, I don't know. We'll see. And then also, you know, even in the U.S. it doesn't work. So one of my sisters lives in Portland, Oregon. And she's funny. Like anytime my other sisters lives up there. So anytime one of them comes from Austin, they bring like a suitcase full of like salsa and fajita meat. like they just go to the local grocery store and they like stock up on stuff and put it in the freezer. So even in Portland. Yeah. But so I'm thinking, we'll see. Maybe I'll have to bring, because salsa usually comes in a glass jar and you don't have to like refrigerate it. So if we can, but then you can make salsa. I mean, they have jalapenos there, I'm sure.
Oh, yeah.
And then we can also make this stuff. So then I think the other major thing, there's probably two other things. I'm sure there'll be other stuff, but I'm anticipating missing. One is like, I mean, we'll lease a car, but I don't think there'll be as much like freedom of car stuff. I think I'll get used to that though. Like the thing that's easy around here is like parking. Like you just park. There's no hassle. Whereas like over there in Europe, at least in the city areas, like parking is like, we got to find some parking. It was even like that in like New Zealand.
Yeah.
In Auckland, but that's fine. Yeah. I don't think the car thing's a big deal. Maybe what I'll miss is having a huge car. Like we'll have to get like a little Subaru or something.
Yeah. Okay. Right. I have things to say about the car, but yeah. And, but what's the other one?
And then, oh, free refills on your drinks. I mean, that's, I get, and there's a fourth thing, but that is, there's two things every time I come back, as they say, stateside, that I look forward to. There's three things that I look forward to. One of them is free refills on your non-alcoholic drinks, right? And a subset of that is like, when you sit down, they often just bring you a huge glass of water. They're just like, you're going to want some water. So here you go, free, boom. And there's no distinction. If you wanted, what do they call it? Gas. If you wanted gas water, the wait staff, here's another unconvincing accent. The wait staff would look at you and be like, what are you, some kind of fancy lad?
Yes, I am.
So you just get free water. And then you get an iced tea, just free refills. Like, you have to tell them to stop refilling it, right? So that gets to be good. And then also, I look forward to the American coffee, which I think the whole rest of the world would call the worst, most terrible coffee ever. But I just like it. It's what I grew up with. It's just this watered down, like, American coffee that's very mild. Love that stuff. You know what else you get? Free refills on coffee. I'm just saying, something to look into.
Okay.
Maybe if y'all didn't spend all that money on trains.
Okay.
And then the third thing that I look forward to when I come back is, I don't know. And this is one of those things where, like, whatever. Like, I look forward to, like, a diversity of people and, like, hearing Spanish. Like, it's like, I you realize how little of that, of those two things, at least I get when I'm abroad, but that you get a lot when you're here. So it's just like, Spanish is, in Austin, is, it's not a lot, but you hear it here and there. And there's, like, a lot of Hispanic people, and, like, there's more diversity, and definitely, like, African American people, or presumably other Africans, I don't know, but people who are, you know, black in skin color.
Yeah.
And there tends to be a lot more of that. And then there's also, like, diversity in just, like, just weight. Right? Like, and all good and bad meanings of the word, like, body sizes and, like, the, you know, for all of the problems that we have as far as, like, people that we like and dislike in the aggregate, like, we do have, like, it is like a melting pot of physiological kind of language things, which is hard to get in, like, maybe in, like, in London, even. No, London has diverse, but still, even London doesn't have as much, I feel, as you get here in even Austin, or especially in, like, San Francisco. Plus, no free refills.
Right. I have things to say about this.
Please.
First, the car thing. I understand what you mean, but I think I think there will be enough novelty and enough sort of replacement function available to you that the things you miss will be made up for by the new stuff. So the advantage of the advantage is that everyone's in a car the same size. You know, it's not like you're going to be in a tiny car, everyone else is going to be in a huge car. And I think the infrastructure of places like Amsterdam is really thought out. So, you know, the parking systems and transferring from a car to a tram to a train, those sorts of things, they're really well thought out, or at least better than the UK, I think, generally. And it just works. It really does work. And it's the things that didn't feel like an option before now feel like, oh, we can just get a tram. Why would you not get a tram? And that is a really nice feeling, I thought, of dependability. And you could just turn a corner, there was a tram or a bus or whatever, and, you know, I didn't feel like I'd be waiting 45 minutes or something like that. The refills, that all this, honestly, my instant reaction to this is, if you're going to refill it, it must be crap, it must be terrible, otherwise they're not going to give this stuff away. I mean, it's like, if you're charging,
I don't drink soft drinks or soda, but you get refills on that, which most people, I think, consider, I mean, I don't drink it because I'm with you, I think it's crap. But it's not just water and iced tea. It's just any non-alcoholic or non-artisanal drink you generally get a refill on.
I wouldn't trust it. Couldn't do it. Yeah. Couldn't do it.
Yep.
No ice. No, can't do that. The interesting thing is about the, as it were, the range of people you find in a place is what you were saying about the difference between, say, Austin and London is exactly what I think, but the other way around. So my perception is exactly the same as yours, but the other way around. I think, hey, London is a kind of really mixed place, loads of people from loads of different countries, and I hear different languages all the time. If I went to Austin, in my head, it's like, they're all Americans.
No, I think I'll probably find that's true. I think and I was kind of stumbling this. I think there's just a different set of differences, and
definitely,
that kind of checks out in my head when I think about it. I guess, and then also, I mean, this is always a perilous topic to discuss, but I'll try to do it in a very non-judgmental, political way. Like, the difference is especially striking when you go over to Asia, which tends to be a lot more homogenous. At least to my eyes, right? Like, maybe people look and they're like, boom, these are all different types of people. But you know, kind of like you're saying, like, they, you know, it seems pretty homogenous. Like, I was in Seoul and I was in Singapore. Singapore, not very homogenous. But anyways, we'll see. It might just be that I just miss, like, Hispanic people and stuff.
Well,
but I'll get used to new things.
Yeah. I mean, in the Netherlands, again, you know, I'm sure there are lots of people from Indonesia in the UK and in London, but I don't go to places where those people are very noticeable to me. And when I was in the Netherlands, suddenly it was like, okay, this is, I understand where these people are from and what things I can buy in these shops and what restaurants I can go to and what language these people are speaking. And that was definitely a noticeable difference, because it's definitely a shift from London to Amsterdam and London to the Netherlands.
It seems like there's a whole lot more Eastern Europeans in Europe. I mean, I guess because they're European, for one thing.
Yes.
But we don't have that many Eastern Europeans over here. Maybe on the East Coast, but you never really, and I'm just guessing from accents and things like that, but you don't really encounter Eastern Europeans, like, I don't know, outside of the Northeast of the U.S. I feel like maybe in the huge cities, but, like, they don't come up that much.
Yeah, London often has kind of like big groups of people arriving. So, and it has done probably since the 1600s or something. Well, earlier than that. So you will
just
suddenly
starting with the Romans who just
starting with the Romans, those bastards. So you'll suddenly notice people who are from Lithuania or Finland or something like that, and there'll be a great influx of people and another big change in London and another layer onto the city, which is what it's for. I mean, it's a very London thing.
Yeah.
You see new groups of people arrive and make London into something else. And yeah, I definitely miss that.
Yeah, but it's probably because BA makes a new partnership with the frequent flyer program.
Well, I was about to make some remark about being in or out of Europe, but I'm definitely not going to say anything about that.
So, yeah, you know, I hadn't thought of that quite. It'll be interesting to see what the differences are. Like, I started, I always say his name wrong, but I started reading a new Alan de Botton book, Botain.
Yes.
And it's his book about...
I'm just going to let you go with it.
I started reading his book about traveling, and it advertises itself as... It doesn't talk about the what of traveling, but the why of traveling. And I think his outlook, I've only read that Heathrow book of his, I think, but I think his outlook on things will be like good. It's a good like playbook for like being a stranger in a place that lives somewhere, you know? And I never got into that whole Bill Bryson stuff. Maybe I should read his stuff, but he's a little too, I don't get a good sense from him. I don't think he fits with my worldview. But I think this Botton guy, like he seems, he has like comfortable skepticism about everything, which I feel like his approach to everything, to use in my words, is like, I'm not sure about this fucking shit. Like, but I'll scope it out.
Chapter two.
I think he's like the literary equivalent. You know that Fry meme. Fry from Fry is like squinting his eyes, and he's like not sure if this is actually a donut or whatever. I think that's the tone of the bottom guy.
Well, Merlin Mann. I remember Merlin Mann saying something about traveling years ago, which Merlin needs to cheer up. Which was a thing that he said was, wherever you go, you still take your luggage with you, which obviously is like, hey, you're still you, which is correct and right, but also you are in a different place. I'm not suggesting that people can or necessarily should kind of reinvent themselves, kind of Walter Mitty style, every time you get off a plane, but there is a different feeling about certain places, and you are able to live in a different way. And sometimes that change can be really good.
Well, it's interesting you say that, because that was the conclusion of like the first chapter of the traveling book, which he went to Barbados, and he was like, and then I was in Barbados and I started thinking of like all these other things, and my partner or spouse like stole some of my dessert, which upset me. And I realized, and to use yet another wording, as I think it was from Mad Max 2, like, no matter where you go, there you are. That you don't leave yourself behind. I forget how I should find it. He words it in his clever way. He's like, you know, people often find that they have accidentally brought themselves on their trip.
Like, okay.
But he seemed to like Barbados.
Slumming it. How did you like it?
Well, so it was all right. He had another good point, and then we can get to some, you know, some recommendations, but he had another good point, which I liked, was when you travel, you imagine that it's basically like your house, the airport, your hotel. But in fact, he doesn't say a million different things, but there's innumerable different things in between there that, one, you're not anticipating, and also you kind of forget. Like, in his example was like, so when we got off of, he flew on BA, so that's good of him. When we flew the BA flight from like London to Barbados, we then had to wait in line to get our passport checked by this person sitting at a desk. And then also we had to wait at the baggage claim, and there was this ratty carousel of things. And there was a sign for like this thing, and he just kind of lists all these things. And that's when he was like, no one really ever thinks or remembers all this little shit between getting from point A to point B.
Yes.
All sorts of lowercase Roman numerals that you have to deal with.
Yes.
But what do you have to recommend this episode?
I don't know who suggested recommendations. Whoever suggested this, it really, I just think you're setting people up for failure here. Mm. And every time you do it on your proper podcasts, I think everyone's sorted out. They've got a whole list of things. That's when I like to listen at half speed, so I can write everything down.
Half speed. Well, it's in the show notes. I'm just saying.
Is it?
Yeah, yeah.
Oh God! All these years.
Yeah, I spend so much time on those show notes. I don't think anyone looks at them.
No, definitely not. The thing I'm actually going to recommend is actually. And this is ripping you off. When you described it as slowing down, and you could describe it as I describe it in a way for me as damnably lazy listening. So when people say to me, "You're a really good listener," it means I'm so lazy and I haven't actually bothered to contribute to the conversation in any sense at all. I just sat there with like a 1,000-yard stare on my face, and people imagine that it's all going in and somehow getting like processed. Like,
yeah.
God, Robert, he's really listening to what I'm saying.
I suppose
I, you know, kind of like, but the thing is that the thing I recommend to myself, and I remember to myself, is most of the people I work with and all some of them are also really fun people. And if I'm genuinely missing out, and this is the reason I've is because I do get a it's not what I'm, you know, supposed to be working in or supposed to develop any expertise in. It's keeping my ears open is the best thing I've done with my time. It really has been. And, you know, sitting down and thinking and trying to work through stuff with people, listening, always. Really love it. I could go for a week just listening, but unfortunately I'm paid not to just listen.
That's true. Yeah, as I think I mentioned on some other podcasts, like I read this book on nonviolent communication, and there is a lot of emphasis on maybe not listening, but make sure that you understand what someone's saying, which therefore is listening. Which you know, that sounds delightful, and I think the other, at least the other part, to be all NBC, what I hear you saying is it's also like kind of relaxing. To just listen to people.
Yeah. I mean, the thing is that I actually take people really seriously. I am interested in what they say, and I should probably act more to make sure that I'm telling them that. Because when I say, I mean, people have all these weird kind of tics when they speak, and one of the things I find myself, apart from I'm sure I'm repeating myself, is that a really good point, which makes it sound like everything else they say has been absolute rubbish, and it's only that one thing they just said which was worth listening to. And that's not what I mean. I have suddenly, you know, kind of rebooted and come alive because of something they've just said, not that everything else was rubbish.
Well, here's the I'll give you a little tool. I don't know if it works. This whole, I'm fascinated by this, as they say, NBC stuff, but it just looks really unpractical. So you know what I needed? I need the O'Reilly edition of non-thin
volume,
which the O'Reilly stuff would be good, because it's basically just like, here actually is what you type into the command line, right? Like, and what works and doesn't work. But anyways, I think in your case, what the NBC people would say to do is as a way to like, gift someone, to let them know that you appreciate what they've been saying and it's good points, is you would say, you would somehow figure out a way to tell them how it gave you something that you needed that addressed a way that you were feeling, right? And so it would be like, instead of saying like, that was a good point, I guess you would say something like, I had never thought about that and I was confused, and now you really helped solve an intellectual issue that I've needed. Like, apparently, that's one of the theories here is that people, if they're in the right frame of mind, what people enjoy doing is doing things that others need. And then there's another theory that it's like, which this actually is like the most interesting theory of the whole thing, is that most, let's say you've got two people, like you're talking with someone, and most people are not really good about saying what they actually need. And so if you're talking with them, it's really confusing because you don't know what to do, right? Like especially if someone's like complaining, it's like there's an example that he uses over and over again, where there's a couple on one of these, speaking of airports, on like an airport train. And the husband is just like, this train is so slow. And the wife is just kind of nodding. And then he says it like four more times. He's just like, this train is so slow. And finally the wife is like, yes, but what do you want me to do about it? Right. And like, it's kind of a silly example of like, just tell me what you need. Right. And like, if all you need is for me to say like, this train sure is slow, I know it's upsetting to you.
Yeah.
Then even that would be nice to know, let alone the more complicated things of like group dynamics and working on a project at work or in your home life. Like, it's hard. And I'm as they say, guilty of this as anything else, but like, you know, you got to tell people what you need. Otherwise they get confused and then things spiral into conflict.
Yes. And something I've noticed, I have one colleague I'm particularly thinking of who is very good at this. like really good at expressing what is the best thing, what is the best coal to shovel into that boiler. And we are so unused to communicating in that way that I've noticed them in conversation and in meetings saying very directly what's required and people not getting it because they're so unused to that earlier way of hearing someone complain or something like that. But to hear and listen to someone speaking clearly is unusual enough for people to just assume that it is just not going to happen.
And that's what I find jarring about the whole theory is like thinking back when I've been around people who are like very direct and quick. Yes. Like, I kind of think they're assholes, right? Like, it's just like, whoa, buddy, slow your roll. Like, let's do the whole ceremony thing where we fart around for like 30 minutes. And then you sort of kind of tell me what you want so that I can sort of kind of tell you I don't want to do it.
I have a great deal of sympathy with this, particularly for me personally, because I do a lot of thinking while I'm speaking. And I think and speak at the same time. I try not to, but I'm not as quick on my feet as most of the people I know. I just need a lot more time before I can straighten everything out in my mind. I also spend a lot of time thinking. It's the thing I do most.
Slow. This is why you and I get along. But man, we should. I think maybe next episode we should talk about that. I've come to believe, and to couch it ironically, I have about a 75% confidence that way of operating. Most people don't like that.
That is a very good point,
and it causes a lot of problems. Right? Like it's just like you can't just go through life exposing everyone to the often conflicting rambling thought train in your head. Like it's not fit for consumption.
Okay. What I said there was that's a really good point or something like that. But following on from what you said previously, the thing that was most useful that you said to me then was when you said most people don't like that. And that is for me a very good summary of the response. It's a liking and a disliking. It's very interesting. And yes, we should talk about that. Do you have any? What recommendation do you have?
I have a very short recommendation, which is more of proof of an obvious one, which is like, so you know, we're selling our house, we're moving, can't take much stuff. It turns out, pretty much everything you own, you don't actually need. You can just get rid of it. Like we spend a lot of time going through stuff and there's just like boxes and boxes and bags of just like stuff that you don't need. And I don't know, you know, there's this concept of the time value of money, which boil it down to its simplest is a dollar today is worth a lot more than a dollar tomorrow. It's like the inverse Wimpy principle of hamburger loans. And so I think there's also probably there's some sort of similar thing of like the value of stuff, which I think is the greater the chance you will have to deal with a thing, the less valuable it is to own. And now it's not overall like valuable. It just waits it to be less valuable, right? So for example, here we have a gigantic 5-bedroom house. And we've just got like a closet full of stuff, doesn't matter, right? Like, I don't care. But if I had to go clear out that closet, that stuff now becomes worth a lot less, which is annoying. But I think consequently, like, you should not have a lot of stuff. It's going to be a hassle. And then also you just have that shit and it's just like, what do you need it for? I don't know. But you got to be careful because if you're living somewhere for 5 years, and you accumulate a lot of gift wrapping material and you're going to be giving people a lot of gifts, then like you want that stuff. You know what I mean? But then if you're like moving, you're like, why do I have all these gift wrapping material? Right. So it's hard to evaluate that. Well, I got to wrap up. for fun to go record another podcast. But that's right. Or I don't know. they're all proper in their own ways, depending on what the needs of people are and how it makes them feel.
That is absolutely true. You're right. You're right. You realize.
Well, I don't know which episode this is, but if you want to get the show notes, which on these are very sparse. If you go to cashedout.coffee, then you can find them. And with that, we'll see everyone next time. Bye-bye.
Bye.